Joseph was the founder of the St. Agathe Heritage Committee. He's a respected Laurentian historian, and he has written two books, and he has more. His lovely wife is sitting at the back there with some of his books to sell. And they have now come up with something new that each talk he gives, he will put his notes and photos that he's had into a pamphlet form and sell them. So the first try at this from Joseph and his wife is the talk he gave here last year. And she has the books at the back. One of the really interesting books he wrote that I think is called The Naming of the Laurentians, and it was a history of, it is for sale at the back, and it is a history of place names, as we say, up north. And that book has been translated into French also by Michel Tisserre as Nomme les Laurentides. Now you know why I don't speak French. La Petite Histoire des Cantons du Nord, as well as Insatiable Hunger, which is what he's going to talk to us about today. Colonial Encounters in Context, Joseph has also been published in the Montreal Gazette, Canada's History Magazine, the Doncaster Ballyhoo, and has regular columns in the Quebec Heritage News and the Main Street. We get the Quebec Heritage News regularly. I forget when they publish it, because we are members of QAN. I say QAN, I don't know. The Quebec, what is it? Anglophone Heritage Network, yes. And those magazines are in our movable library, and you can feel free to take them out. Let me see, what else about Joseph here? He sat on the board of the St. Agathe Hospital and piloted the twinning of St. Agathe and Saranac Lake, towns that have remarkably similar histories. So today he's going to give his talk on Insatiable Hunger, an exploration of worldviews that underpinned settler colonialism. So I have talked quite a bit. Over to you.
Thanks very much. Should I use this? I guess I should. I think it's better if I use this. Am I wrong? Yeah, okay. I'll just keep going with it then. Last year, I really enjoyed talking with you. Really nice group of people, good interjections, good questions. It was a very worthwhile and fun event. So I was keen to come back, and so I came back. I'm going to just leave anyone who wishes to throw this out for me. What do you think of when you see this land acknowledgement, or when you hear it? Is it important to you? Or is it part of something that you think we should keep hearing? Yes?
I think it's important to recognize that we are here as invaders.
Yeah, that's,
whether,
yeah.
Whether we want to recognize it or not,
yeah.
It is a fact.
Very interesting. Was there another? We were not invited, no, this is true.
On the other hand, if you think about the borders there, how were they actually created, they were garrison walls. So how much invitation was there? That's also an interesting question.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you. My particular preoccupation there is the idea, and I think it feels much more real now than it ever did before to me. And that is that one day I would come home and discover that it's occupied and I'm not welcome. And I had no notice of this. I do not belong, that the laws have changed, the rules have changed, and they're asking me to move to a particular reserve. it's not so unimaginable, unfortunately, today as it may have been 20 years ago. You know, it's just, it leaves a chill. And try to find the roots of that. Thank you for that. Thank you for that comment, because I think it's very, very pertinent to this talk. And I will address it very, very much in the talk, so I'm very grateful. Okay, well, once more, and then I'll go.
We have recently moved here from Winnipeg. I would like to point out that the premier of the province of Manitoba is indigenous Anishinaabe, member of the Anishinaabe Nation, and he is the governor, the premier of the province. He is very well-liked. He's a very high popularity rating, and let me tell you, the indigenous people in Manitoba are really giving a really good feeling, good premier canoe as provincial premier of Manitoba. He's doing some great things. And I think the land acknowledgement is very pertinent, especially in that context, but also here in Quebec or in any other place in Canada. Government of Canada promotes or accepts this land acknowledgement as part of the reconciliation process that began years ago. So I think it's very important that we continue to acknowledge the land we are on. And we're not first, we're settlers, and we're here by the grace of the original population.
Thank you. What I want to tell you is, from my perspective and my research, indigenous people are the foundational form of human nature. Indigeneity, or indigenous people, live everywhere in the world, and they have always been a keystone species. That is to say, they create order in their society, and they encourage growth. They belong, they don't own. And that short phrase, I think, is a very, very fundamental fact that we have to deal with, and that we have to deal with while we still have time to do so. I feel that the society that we lived in that we're living in right now comes from pastoral roots, from the herding cultures that began in Central Europe. And it's not natural. And it's where we are today. And it caused the Scythians and all of those other nations to fight with each other endlessly and bleed. The indigenous people of the Americas have a civilization that began similarly to when Egypt began. However, they have never developed weapons to kill other human beings. The weapons they have for hunting is what they end up having to do when they have fights. They've never been a warring in spite of all you might have seen in Hollywood, there was no indigenous military objective. They welcomed people from the beaches. They wooed them to come in. One of the first questions they asked was, where are your women? They couldn't understand these poor, bedraggled, dirty, small men arriving on the shores and looking lost. And they helped them. And that was how that began. So what I want to discuss is indigeneity and pastoralism. Pastoralism is the most successful human presence since human presence started to diverge from that foundational role. And it has grown and has shown extraordinary flexibility, and it is an extraordinary, we live in this civilization that has its roots in pastoralism. It led to the concept of property, to social hierarchies, to male dominance, which was not natural. It led to even the concept of a personal god. It led to capitalism. Unfortunately, it also led to hoarding and to the concept of the apex predator, which is not a keystone species. But before starting, I wanted to get back to language, because I could give this talk in French, so if you are French and want to ask anything in French, I'm very happy to answer in French. But what I want to say about language is in the head you see here, it's because if you've heard of Thompson Highway was a polymath from northern Manitoba who was literally born in a snowbank on the Thompson Highway, and that's where he got his name. He turned out to be, if you read him, you will read a person full of the greatest happiness. He's an indigenous, a Cree playwright. He's also a pianist. He's got so many skills, it's just boggling. If you want to read his own story, it's called Permanent Astonishment. It's just a beautiful display of how he sees the world. But what he says is that English is the best language for intellectual discussion. He said, but be careful because it stops at the neck. And that's the head. So down below the head, the neck, the body, French is a very good language. But if you want to talk about the whole language, the whole body, use an indigenous language. And I was thinking, okay, this is interesting. And what I had seen in my research was I discovered William Johnson. William Johnson was an Irishman who got himself thrown out of university in Ireland. He had some good chances to go places. His uncle was very involved in the New York colony and got him in to give him a second chance. He was married into a Huguenot Dutch family, and it was a family of lively good times. And William Johnson fit in very well with them until he decided to strike out on his own. And then he went out and he began trying to find his place in this new society. And he found this place among the Mohawk. He was a very, very good businessman, and he made himself quite wealthy. And he had a way of being that treated the indigenous people who came to him exactly the same way as he treated the whites. No special, nothing special either way. So the indigenous people trusted him, the Mohawk people trusted him, and then he found that he would practically live with them. He would wrestle, he learned the language, he would give talks to them in their language, and he grew with them. He was always more a schemer and dreamer, if you want, than they were probably prepared to deal with. But what happened is the 13 colonies out-schemed him because they all were dealing with at the time, the Five Nations in New York, who were very, very significant. Mohawk was the Eastern Door, as we call it, and it was the most Eastern one. And when each of the colonies, the colonist governors, managed to basically talk with the Five Nations and have a different story for each one and show that they were not trustworthy, the Five Nations finally realized that they couldn't work with them anymore and they broke away. And this was very serious to the British. Back in England, they were shocked by this because it meant that the main power in the area was being lost and would go right away to the French. And so they looked into the situation and asked William Johnson what to do. And they asked him if he would be the superintendent of Indian affairs in the New York area and basically that whole area. He accepted, but how the indigenous people accepted him is they saw him as their ambassador. And suddenly he was talking directly to the crown rather than through the governors. So he suddenly was in a situation where the Five Nations was talking directly to the government in England instead of having to go through the governors. And this was a bit startling to the governors because it meant that they had a recognized nation beside them. Over time, the 13 colonies got more and more powerful and less patient and felt more and more bottled in. And William Johnson negotiated a border to try to keep everyone happy. Things got worse and worse until finally they all came to his place. And they did this regularly to have a conference. And this was his place in Johnson, New York. The way the indigenous people communicated was with their whole body. It was an exhausting way of presenting. The body language, the movements, every aspect was physically demanding as well as meaningful. And your time to speak would come in turn, but in the meantime, you did not interrupt. This was something that I read about. I thought this was very interesting, but I never really understood it until I found myself talking with some indigenous people and realized my incapacity to leave any quiet spaces. And after a while, I sort of tried to shut up and let them decide how things were going forward. And I watched when one person began to speak, everyone else shut up. It was dead quiet in that room until that first person was finished speaking, and then another person would start. And so I, with difficulty, got into the rhythm. In this particular emergency event, William Johnson's turn to speak came days after the start. And when it came, it was really hot, a late spring day. And he got up and he gave a speech that had a very great impact. But somewhere in the middle of the speech, he just collapsed in exhaustion. His partner was the head of the matrons of the Iroquois. He is basically married into the Mohawk Nation. And she brought him to his room. And it brought to my mind how exhausting it can be to talk fully in that way. That was the day he died. And when he died, the indigenous people realized, the Mohawk realized they had a really big problem. Things were going ahead way too fast. But I want to talk a little bit about not just him, it's just that this is why I want to talk about language. Learning to communicate in this way is beyond me, but I admire it, and I hope someday to be able to understand it. Jacques Cartier was the first, in this area, was the first person to arrive from Europe, or the first group. And Jacques Cartier really didn't understand what he was doing. He was coming looking for gold. The Spanish had found gold, so why not the French? You know, they were going to bring gold back. And he met Iroquoian people in Gaspé, and he talked with them. They treated him very, very well. They gave him feasts. They wanted to exchange with him, set up some kind of gifting with each other, and that's how their culture worked. The gifting worked until one day they saw him building erecting a gigantic cross on the shore. They weren't stupid. They realized that he was claiming the territory. And so they objected. They had no language in common. They couldn't understand each other. They objected, and he tried to reassure them that it was just a way of finding his way back to see them again. So he called them into a meeting to come and join him on the ship with instructions to his people that when it was time to leave, grab the last two and pull anchor. He grabbed the last two were the chief Donnacona's sons. He sailed back to France with them, and over the next year they learned French, and they guided him back, and they brought him to where they actually lived, which was way up the St. Lawrence in a place called Stadacona, where Quebec is today. And he brought them to the house, and then they would refuse to go anywhere else with him. He wanted to go further. He wanted to go to the place that they that he had learned so much through them about, where the center of the whole area was further than Hochelaga, further than the rivers. And you have to go there if you want to really know this world. But they refused to take him. He said, we will be your intermediaries, at least at first. And he refused. He went up on his own. He went to Hochelaga. He saw it. He realized he could not go further because he didn't have the boats. He didn't have the methods to get over the rivers. And he came back and discovered that his men that he had left behind had to build a fort to protect themselves because they were so anxious about the activities that were going on. He realized that he had to make everyone relax, and he succeeded. He brought sort of a calmness to both sides, and he had to spend the winter there. He had no choice. He couldn't make it back in the winter. So he spent the winter there and suffered terribly from scurvy. And they showed him how to deal with scurvy. They helped him through it. They helped him protect. But he didn't want them to know how weak they had become and how many had died. And in the spring, again, he invited them all on board, and he took off with 10 of them this time, went back to France, and didn't return for years and years. The king finally sent him back to create a colony, and he was creating a colony for bringing a group of businessmen who said, if you give us exclusive trading rights, we can create a colony for you, and we will trade with the people. The person he brought back was Roberval, who was a Protestant. And part of the Protestant objective was to have a safety net because the tensions between Catholics and Protestants were rising to points of violence in France. Cartier went ahead, back to Stadacona, discovered he was not welcome, tried to convince everybody that the 10 other people who were dead had found wonderful lives in France and didn't want to come back. They saw through him, and they just chased him away. He had to leave. He met Roberval back at a port that they had settled in Newfoundland and said, there's nothing we can do here. They're not going to accept us. And Roberval said, look, the king put us on orders to do this, so we have to go and try. And he said, okay. Set out to sea and disappeared to France, leaving Roberval by himself. Roberval went ahead to where he was supposed to go and discovered what Cartier had said. Roberval doesn't disappear from history after that. He went back to France. Cartier does. We don't hear from him anymore. But Roberval does, because the Catholics raided a funeral at a Protestant church and killed everybody. And he was one of the people who died. So when I was learning all of this, I was saying, what the heck was going on? And discovered the wars of religion in Europe. And I realized that if I want to write about what I feel about here, I'm not an indigenous. I don't have the voice of an indigenous person. I couldn't have done what William Johnson did. My job is to talk about the people who are my people, the colonists, what we did. And so I started exploring that, and I was exploring it in the context of the indigenous reception of those people. Because then I wasn't talking about the indigenous people, I was talking about the relationship, and I felt that I had a justification for doing that. And that's where the book Insatiable Hunger came from, was that relationship. However, all the time writing it, I was learning about indigenous people and the culture and what it meant, and I was learning this concept of that foundational aspect of indigeneity, how everywhere in the world there are indigenous people, old cultures, and they all have the same values. They all have that same, the same seven generation rule, that when you're doing anything, you have to see seven generations ahead, because you have an obligation to the future. Even the Celts in Ireland, the Laplanders, the indigenous people in the Philippines, it doesn't matter where you go, if you'll find these same foundational rules that existed at one point everywhere. And then I came to feel that there was much more to learn. Insatiable Hunger was pretty much ready to go to get published. But I was having a panic attack, if you want. I was ready to just junk the whole thing. Felt I was way out of my depth, couldn't do this, and I should just abandon the project. And sort of out of desperation, I reached out to a woman named Barbara Alice Mann, who is at Seneca, Ohio, from a university professor, who had written some books that I had read about indigeneity. And I asked her if she would look at my manuscript. She got back to me and said, I want you to do this. It's very good. I'm going to give you some facts that will improve your indigenous side on this. But even if it's too late to put them in, doesn't matter, because your central message is good. And your central message is the message that I've been sharing with you, that there's something wrong here. There's something wrong with the what we have created. I've kept in touch with her and kept following the different things that she also has written. And this is her latest book, The Woman Who Married the Bear. She wrote it together with a woman from Lapland, and it talks about that foundational knowledge, where it came from, what it was. And they were exploring, trying to figure out what happened, what made it change. It's a very, very hard task to do. I don't know if you can read it, but the authors are Barbara Alice Mann and Karina Kylo. They each wrote half the book, and they both describe the early influence of the bear culture. These early cultures that we're talking about, we should not think of as primitive. We should not think of them, we should not categorize them or put them into any kind of a time hierarchy or anything. We should just try to see them for what they are. And these are the cultures that learned, their fundamental role was to learn from the elders. And the elders are all the other sibling species. So they have this profound relationship with the other species, to the point of realizing that humans cannot take up more space than they should, and therefore they control the size of their populations. How they did this, one of the methods is explored in how the women learn from the bear. to keep feeding the cub milk to keep yourself from a second pregnancy as long as you can. The bear didn't tell them that in words, at least not in Cree or Lap or any of the other languages that could have been possible, but the message came through that there was that the human function was to maintain humans at a population that was consistent with a total understanding of their world. And one of the ways, as I say, was the what would you call it, postponing eustrus through milk breastfeeding. It was effective. Another quick mention here is we are in the territory of the Nattawick Algonquian civilization. Now, I think we talk about each of the different regions, the different indigenous nations, but in fact we are in the northeastern North America was part of this whole civilization. And right across the Americas there are groups with very similar fundamental values that were all indigenous. Now, some of them are quite different, so you can't make any generalized statements about the total, except that those values that I mentioned about respecting our place in nature. And nature does not, because their language is not a language of nouns, of names, it's a language of verbs. It's a very active language. Their gender is not, it shows no great significance. It's their animation that sort of shows significance. So everything is how spirits. The animate, is that water for me? Yeah, okay. I don't think anyone else is taking it, so I better, because otherwise I'm suddenly going to have no voice and be stuck just with using my body, and I don't think you guys would appreciate that. Sheila and I drove down, and we have this habit of the passenger reads a book out loud to both of us in the car. And we decided I should stop so I didn't use up my voice, so hope I stopped in time. George Seewee is the person who describes that, the Nattawick Algonquian civilization. You won't see it very often, but it's a good way of seeing it. Nattawick is an Algonquian term for Iroquoian people. Algonquian is a basically French term for Anishinaabe. So you have this crazy, crazy mix-up. So now I think that this map you see the yellow areas are what we call hunter-gatherers. This is 4,000 years ago. This was as the world is imagined. Hunter-gatherers are basically the majority of the landmass of the world at that time. And if you look in here around the Mediterranean, you see a bunch of different colors, complex farming, nomadic pastoralism, state societies, and so on. Basically, state societies, complex farming, nomadic pastoralism fit into systems that developed hierarchies. The strange thing about pastoralism is Anki Becker from Harvard did a study showing that her interest was the roots of female genital mutilation. She was a statistician, more of a scientist than anything else. And she demonstrated that male dominance arose through herding societies. There are other arguments for other ways it could have arisen, but this is one. And her argument I found very interesting because it also led to male hierarchies for defense. And it also led to zoonotic disease interchange with species. Because what you would have to imagine, and I think she touches on this, is that you have a very difficult period where there's not many resources. And some young guys go out and they move in basically with a herd of lambs or sheep or goat or something like this. And they become their protectors from their natural predators. And every once in a while they take some animals and bring them back. Now in terms of the foundational concepts, this was by itself breaking a code, because you don't treat a fellow species as something that you can control. And they were controlling it. In a very short time, they realized that the predators they were defending it from were other people doing exactly the same thing. So the sense was that they were basically at war with each other over the property that they were protecting. So a few concepts arise at the same time. One is the transfer of disease. Two is the hierarchies of defense. And three is this fundamental of breaking the rules. So this is where it seems that pastoralism arose. Pastoralism was extremely effective, largely because the people who carried these zoonotic diseases basically recovered from them over time. They would have a die-off. A lot of people would die generation after generation, but after a while you would have these people who were actually immune to these. And if anyone attacked them or if they went into any other place, they would contaminate them. These new people would just die off. The disease would destroy them, weaken them, so that pastoralism and its diseases became a dominant part of Eurasia. And you can see these areas that would have practiced or been influenced by it are right through the center here. There's a little bit in South America, not much else. Not in the same way. The exposure of the hunter-gatherer structure is sort of dismissed as humans living in a very primitive style, basically scrounging their life, like fighting for what they can kill and eat. And it's not really accurate. They did not herd the animals, and they did not live with them. What they did is they monitored them. They would kill weak ones and eat them, but their basic protein was actually fish. They had huge resources of fish in the rivers, which they improved dramatically. Because they controlled the size of their population, they would have controlled their body health, absolutely. So your point is absolutely right on accurate there. By the same token, they were not exposed to this dense European situation where diseases had been in the society for maybe 10,000 years. And the die-off in Europe and Asia to these diseases was probably as high, but it was spread over thousands and thousands of years. Where when they came to places where there was no resistance to it, the diseases spread and killed very, very rapidly. The Mohawk, for instance, When we hit there, 50% of the people died. The whole Iroquoian society that surrounded the Great Lakes, not just the Five Nations, collapsed. Their civilization numbers dropped in like a generation to half. And that's really fast. And they had never been locked in prison or anything like that. They just died. And the problem was that these diseases affected the elder and the children. And the elders were the location of the wisdom and guidance of the societies. So they, at the same time as they lost these people, they lost their leadership. They lost how to be able to deal with this new problem. But let's keep looking at them for a bit more, and not, you know, and just note that these things happened. But what I feel is that we missed an opportunity. Imagine if Jesus Christ has said to you, go to the Americas, go carefully, listen, and you'll learn how you should live. But that's not what happened. But the people who are here were probably living much closer to the message that people like Buddha and Jesus Christ actually were the leadership they were showing. George Siwi again calls it an accident. It was an accident. It's very forgiving of him as an indigenous person to call it an accident. But it also helps you be able to try to take the next step and deal with the reality we live in, which is what we have to do. But in terms of proving, I won't try to go there, but this is a graph that shows pastoralism and farming and agriculture itself by gender. And it just sort of underlines that statistically what she found is that the blue is where the male is dominant in pastoralism. In animal husbandry, it's the female, and in agriculture, it's predominantly the female. So when we talk about herding being part of agriculture, what we're doing is we're deforming our own ability to understand it, because herding is a third. Like, if you have hunter-gatherers, you have agriculture, and you have herding, as I see it. In other words, herding is something separate from agriculture. Okay, so anyway, this is a map of the nations that were in around the Great Lakes at the time when the Europeans arrived. You can see, I won't try to read the names to you, but there's a heck of a lot of them. A lot of them are Iroquoian, a lot of them are agricultural. The Iroquoian societies grew lots of food, grew. The Americas mastered agriculture in a way that Europe and Asia didn't, to the point where a huge number of the things we actually eat today were developed by indigenous women over time. We've traced back genetically to the first potato, to the first corn, all these different things, the ages of them. It's very possible that a long, long time ago, other indigenous people developed oranges and bananas. I don't know, but it sort of makes me wonder whether or not. And anyway, it's just a little perspective. If you look at this and you can imagine the population that would fill in the ranks of these names, we have to keep in mind that the population of California was at that time was 50% of North America. The population of the what we call today Mexico and Nicaragua, Central America, was much larger than Rome at the height of Rome. It was a very, very dense population that lived largely on fish, on fishing and fish farming. The Amazon is considered, Thomas Mann is a person who wrote the book 1491, trying to imagine what the Americas looked like in 1491. Said that the Amazon is a human artifact. What happened there was so influenced by human intercession that even the soil has a huge, huge cooked clay content in it. Yet the population is there now. You would never believe there could have been so many people as to make that happen. So these are things we don't know. What we do know is in California, you had four or five different indigenous nations, each with its own specialty, living within each other's worlds, but not affecting each other because they each have different specialties. And the wars they had, which were, they did have wars, the wars they had were basically misunderstandings. Sometimes they were just the fact that someone had broken the foundational rules. But the wars were not wars for the sake of wars. They were not wars for the sake of domination. They were the wars for the sake of just for the for correcting an imbalance as they saw it. And interesting, you know, I'll give you a little observation. I don't want to dwell on it, but in the pastoral societies, what happened over time is that when the men were defending their property, their tribes, from other men, they were not necessarily protecting their women. And it would happen that, it had happened that these people would come back to home where the women and children were and find nobody. They were either all killed or taken away. And then they realized, we realized from that, that that's in a sense where women began to be seen as property by these men, because they had to go and steal some other women from somewhere else to have women. And one of the ways they could guarantee keeping those women was to rape them. And the woman is raped, she's pregnant, she's dependent, and they've sort of got her. In the indigenous culture, like especially with the Iroquoian, they had a genetic exchange as well that was weird and violent like that. But in their case, it was the men. A warrior was taught to learn his song. The song that he would sing as he died. And it would give him the courage to die bravely. And if in one of their wars a man was caught, he would be brought home as a prisoner and given to the women who had lost a man. And they could do what they want with him. And often they would just torture him. They would see how much he could take. And he would start to sing his song to show he could take it. The war now was his courage to show that they couldn't break his spirit. And from the women's point of view is they were going to break his spirit. And if they broke his spirit, they would adopt him. He would become one of theirs. And he would bring with him genes from a different area. Totally different from what we see in the pastoral situation, but an exchange of genes among nations. Anyway, that's just an aside. I don't mean to go there. But one of the other things I wanted to show here was these sketches of New France didn't start in Acadia or in the St. Lawrence River. It started in South America and in Florida. And this is meeting the indigenous people of Florida. And what it shows is the difference in stature. And that was basically the reason, because the men and women were much bigger than the Europeans. Most of the time they were not wearing clothing. They would paint their bodies, and they didn't paint their bodies to look like clothing. They painted their bodies because it was an expression of art. There was a famous story of one of the Five Nations Iroquoian people who came into a city, into a settlement, and he had his face was painted so that he had three eyes, and it was very hard for the people who saw him to realize that one of those eyes, they knew one of them wasn't real, but they couldn't figure out which one. It was so well done, This was an artistic expression that's just absolutely amazing and temporary. I mean, it's there and it's gone. And they weren't tattoos, they were painted. So maybe they could go have a swim and start over. Pardon me? Yeah, luckily. Yeah, let's just go back to that New France situation again. We credit Champlain with being the founder of New France, but in fact, the founder of New France wasn't Champlain, it was the Protestants in Europe. Quebec was set up originally as a safe colony for religious freedom. And the person who is the significant man there is Pierre Dugas-Dumont. Pierre Dugas-Dumont was a warrior with King Henry, who had to take, he was in succession for the French throne, but he was Protestant, he was Huguenot. And so the Catholic League did everything they could to stop him, and it turned into a very messy war, like we saw later in Germany. It was one of these religious wars that was just absolutely nasty. But ultimately, he surrounded Paris and negotiated. And his negotiation was, okay, I will convert to Catholicism. And the saying, which is probably never really happened, he said, Paris is worth a mass. It's worth going to church. But whatever the truth of the story is, he established a freedom of religion in France in his time, the beginning of the 1600s, late 1500s, beginning of the 1600s, he actually established an edict that guaranteed religious freedom of parishes that wanted to remain non-Catholic. The best way to understand it is the churches were service providers. They provided the schools, the hospitals, the emotional health, you name it, they provided it. That's how they came into being, was providing for the people. And they were wonderful until they weren't. And when they weren't, it was because they were taking advantage of their situation. And that's where Protestantism began. And that's where the wars of religion began, because parishes wanted to break away and not be owing to this hierarchy, Catholic hierarchy. So you had these wars that started, and Quebec was set up to be a safe port for those. And Champlain did his best to get, he was very good with indigenous people. He was also a geographer. He found his way. He knew where the best place to go because he understood geography. He also had an ability to deal with the indigenous people so that there wasn't a hostility. And in this particular case, he learned from the Algonquin. Now, the Algonquin and the Algonquian are two different things. The Algonquin are the indigenous people of basically the Ottawa Valley. They were what we call hunter-gatherers, and they were trying to stop the Five Nations from taking over the St. Lawrence Valley for farming. Whether they knew it was for farming or not, they were being pushed into the territory. If you look at indigenous farming, they leave a part of the forest for 90 years between 15-year occupation periods. So they had left Hochelaga, which was Iroquoian at the time of when Cartier left. They had left there, but for whatever reason, probably caused by the Little Ice Age, they'd moved south, and they're coming back in to repossess these territories for farming again. So not so much to repossess them, but to farm on them. But they were moving into other people. And Champlain said, well, I can intimidate them for you. Let's go meet with them in like what we call Lake Champlain today. And they went by river to Lake Champlain, And he worked out with them that when they ended up having a confrontation, he only brought two men with him because the others couldn't make it, refused to come or whatever. But he only brought two Frenchmen. He told the two Frenchmen to stay in the woods out of sight and wait for the signal. And he told the others, the signal would be, as soon as you hear it, you drop to the ground. And as soon as that happened, they shot these guns. So they ventured off into Lake Champlain, and they saw this other group of canoes, and they realized that's the people they were coming to have a battle with. Now, they had these battles, they had a lot of formality to these battles. So they both went to shore in different locations and sent messengers back and forth. Too late in the day to start a fight, eh? Yeah, let's wait in the morning, we'll do it in the morning. In other words, there was a certain format in this. It wasn't just wild. And so in the morning, they confronted each other. Now, there's a lot of inaccuracies in the picture you see here. The Iroquoian people did not fight naked. The Algonquian did. The Iroquoian people had basically dug out elm or hardwood boats, whereas the Algonquian had birch bark canoes. So there's different things that aren't really properly represented. The Champlain did not stand in the front of the group. He hid among them, and at the signal when they dropped, he shot. And his men, he shot three different chiefs. These chiefs had never seen guns before. It caused quite a shock to them. I don't know, but it seems the two same slide is twice in a row for some reason. Oh yes, that's Champlain, and that's the two people in the woods. Anyway, after that, Champlain went back to Quebec, where he had built this building, and discovered that the king had been assassinated in France, and therefore the protection of the Protestants was gone. And it was just a matter of time before he had to make a decision between the existence of the colony, either for the colony to continue to exist, it had to accept Catholicism and the help of the service providers that the Catholics could supply, or he would have to basically fight France and try to become an independent Protestant group that could survive without them, which wasn't likely to happen. It had never been in their intentions or plans. So he chose the Catholic route. But while all this was happening, the Dutch arrived on the Hudson, and they met the Mohawk. And the Mohawk, not really terribly surprising, said, yeah, we'll be happy to trade with you. We want guns. They had never seen guns, and now they wanted guns. Not really surprising. The Dutch, and they made an understanding of this, is called the Caswintha. Generally, we know it as the two-row wampum. It's a wampum belt that shows two groups traveling side by side in peace with each other, without interfering with each other. And that's the foundational agreement between the Dutch and basically the Mohawk. It's a very, very interesting that all of their documentation was through wampum, what is called wampum, but there was these agreements that were put into beads, and these beads came from little shellfish that they would receive as gifts from coastal people, and they would weave into their patterns. And they're basically two colors, white and blue. So what we should talk a little bit about here is, what was that farming that was being done? The huge amount of farming that was done in the Americas, and corn, maize had arrived from Central America into the area of the Iroquoian people. It's believed that the first people to bring it to the Great Lakes was the Kuaka, the people the French called the Neutral. The Neutral Nation. They were Wendat, like the Huron. They lived at the far end of the Great Lakes, and they are, by some people, they're seen as the sort of the mother culture from which other ones sprang and formed. There's no way of knowing how all that happened, but getting back to Barbara Alice Mann, she and some others did a study on when that corn was first arrived, and they estimate at least 1,000 years ago. At the time of its arrival, the social structure was in a disastrous state. And a man came across from the Wendat, north of the lakes, with a mission to try to make the five nations stop fighting with each other. The Wendat had several nations and a much greater population around the Great Lakes, but to the north. And the fundamental difference was that the Wendat traded with the Algonquian peoples, the Ottawa, the Algonquin, all these people that surrounded them. There was constant exchange. And when I say exchange, trading is not the right word, because what they had is a gift culture. If they had a surplus, everyone was invited to share it. And people would bring their surpluses, and there would be speeches and events and celebrations as they shared their surpluses. A person who explores that really well is Robin Kimmerer, and we'll get to her a bit later. But this was a sharing culture, a gift economy. They didn't have money, they didn't need money. They had this method instead. And so the three sisters here are corn, squash, and beans. And this is from Central America. It slowly over thousands of years moved north as different people learned how to select for plants that would grow in different climates. So it couldn't move north faster than the selection allowed it to. But eventually, in the Great Lakes, the maize grew to very, very tall, and it was their fundamental agricultural product. The Jesuits going into the Wendat Huron territory needed guides because the fields were so big, thousands of acres of corn, and that they were farmed for 15 years and then left, go back to the forest for 90 years, and then go somewhere else, because everything had to have its time and its rights. So it's a very, very slow-moving culture. A friend did this in her book, an interior look at a longhouse, the Iroquoian longhouse. Several families would live condominium style, if you want it, with central fires all the way through. The upstairs was for storage and for food storage. There would be a lot of smoke in this environment in the winter because they would keep fires going with holes in the roof. But that smoke was also very effective in making sure the corn was protected. So it's a system that worked. And the different vegetables they would share, in exchange they would get things like maple syrup, canoes, clothing, that the Algonquian people would make these things for them. And so you'd have this balanced economy this way. How are we doing for time right now? Can I get a read on that? It's
maybe another 15 minutes.
Okay, let's sort of wind it up very quickly then, because I mean there's so much to tell. I don't know how to do it all. But so let me just go back, and I'll finish with this and then go on quickly. One of the most extraordinary stories of the Iroquoian people is the Great Law of Peace. I don't know if you've heard of the term, but the Great Law of Peace came into existence there when a man named Degenwiga crossed to the among the Mohawk. He was from a Wendat, came in among the Iroquois and Five Nations people, and discovered that he knew that there was a disaster going on there, and he felt he had a mission to bring them a message of peace. And this corn was just coming in, so this is where it was pertinent to develop different social methods. He found the person whose name survives in our time as Hiawatha. But nothing like the Hiawatha of the legend. This Hiawatha was a cannibal who we found dragging a body home. And he realized the man was dangerous, so he climbed up on the roof of his home and watched him through the smoke hole. And this man started boiling some water. And when he was boiling water, he saw this face reflecting from the pot. And it was very, very, it gave him great peace. So he relaxed. He saw, I don't look that terrible after all. He thought it was himself. Dagon Wida knew what was going on. He came down, he came around and presented himself. And over time, he taught him instead how to mourn a death rather than to kill, and how to substitute. Now, this is the truth of this story is that we don't really know, and it's highly doubtable that there was this level of cannibalism really existed. But what did exist was infighting, terrible infighting. And the next thing Dagon Wida did is he went to the head of the Kuaka, the neutral people, and he met the chief there who told him that she would give their support on the understanding that the land was the responsibility of the women. The men's responsibility was to make sure the land was prepared for the women to grow food on it. And that they should tell all of the women who were feeding the fighting people outside of the villages to protect their villages from fighting people coming in to serve themselves, to tell them about Dagon Wida and Hiawatha's mission and her mission, Jigong Sasha, to try to end this fighting. And they just built a practically unanimous group that finally confronted Adu Daro, who was the head of it. And they said, we want you to be our leader, but we want you to respect this law of peace. And if you can do that, you remain our leader. And the story goes that he was a man with his fingers were snakes, and there were snakes in his hair, and he was a horrid creature, according to these stories that also talked about cannibalism and so much else. What they were trying to do is put the fear into you about how terrible it could be. This is basically the message. And say that Hiawatha combed the snakes out of his hair and brought him to peace. And it's if you see him as Trump, he's being rehabilitated. This society forced its constitution and rehabilitated the leader. I mean, and that's the way they work. They rehabilitated people who went off. If someone killed somebody in the wrong place and their people got criticized for it and did not make amends in some way, there could be a fight. But ultimately, the point was that they could settle things peacefully, and that's what they were trying to learn to do. And this is what was accomplished with the Great Law of Peace. So then I won't go too much into this. You'll find it in the book. The horrible Puritans, frankly. The Puritans were probably the most savage people to ever arrive on the shores of North America. And if you read about them in my book, you'll see why I say that, what the argument is, and how I separate the Pilgrims from that. The Pilgrims were totally different, and you can read about that. Also, just to touch on this, this is breakdown of time by Mayan Aztec cultures, where you can see this is a calendar, if you want. There's 13 months in a year. The days of the month are always the same, and there's 13 of them, so you can follow the calendar. The thing that's very interesting is that the year, whoops, sorry, went the wrong way, the year there, 25th February 2026 would be written like this. It looks to me an awful lot like a computer code, but it was the way they wrote time. And you can look into this. Fascinating. The Europeans said they never even invented the wheel. Well, I don't know. It looks pretty round to me. Now, I'll just quickly review these books if you want to follow up on this. One of the fundamental ones to me is The Children of Atensic by Bruce Trigger. It's a thick book. I read it over 2 years. It's really a lot to learn. It's an incredibly good and well-written thing. The next is another by Barbara Alice Mann. And if you're going to read one of her books, read this one. Barbara Alice Mann will tend to push you away. If you persist, then you learn. But if you don't, she doesn't care. She's going to push you away. You don't want to hear her, that's fine. But you know, I pursued it, persisted, and she has so much to say. She explained to me, fascinatingly, how the concept of the soul is not indigenous. They didn't have souls. They didn't have a concept of souls. They had a concept of spirits. And the spirit was not them. The spirit inhabited. So there's so many differences. Anyway, you learn all that. I mentioned Robin Wall Kimmerer. The service very, very short. The service very, she sort of had to write because her publisher said, look, your book was so popular, write another one. This book, if you haven't read it, read it. It's just, the values she expresses in here are amazing, and they will confirm a lot of the things that I'm telling you about how they lived in this gift culture. Now, one of the things that said, okay, the gift culture is all right, but maybe I should just go back and very quickly read you something. I think it's here. Where is it? No, it's not here. Oh, if I can't find it, I'll just tell it to you. The concept of the Wendigo is another, it's an Algonquian concept, sort of like the Adodaro monster. The concept is a concept of a breakdown of society where people start to become monsters and they're looking for whatever and how it's important to deal to make sure that doesn't happen, that the society doesn't break down. And when we met the first Europeans who came to shore, at first they helped them and thought, great, we're, you know, these people need us. And after a while, they began to realize that these people did not know how to share. They didn't understand gifts. They didn't understand the fundamentals. So they called them the Wendigo. They began to see the Europeans as the Wendigo, this monster that was going to destroy them. So I wanted to know, is there any source of how they would deal with an impossible situation? Would they turn to cannibalism? Would they fight with each other? What would happen? And quickly spoken, Martin Brechtel tells that story in the first three chapters of this book. That's all you really have to read to discover in the Nicaraguan Civil War that he experienced, to discover that he understood there was a stranded Mayan people as a result of an earthquake that the soldiers were keeping anyone from knowing they would starve to death. So he got together with other people and they begged, borrowed food, like played music, put out plates and this kind of stuff, and brought food into these Mayan people, and ultimately discovered that these people had accepted that they were dying. They were comforting each other, they were comforting the children, and they accepted that their role now was to die. They had their time in nature, and there was no even thought of anything else. So it proved to me, and read it, will prove it to you, that they sort of put their money where their mouth was. This was the fact of how they lived. Anyway, I won't go further because we were out of time. This is a picture of insatiable hunger, and if we have time for a few questions, probably just one or two even, if you have them, let me know, and if not, we can exchange by email.
Just before we have some questions, I'd like to thank you very much for coming again, and I know you've come from up north. Wasn't the best day to travel, I guess, but I think we learned a very different take on what most of us probably learned in school. It's been very interesting. So I'd like to thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't expect to.
And
thank you.
Questions, and then afterwards there will be tea and coffee. Maybe you would like a glass of water before people ask questions.
Well, yeah, okay, I'll sip. Are there any observations or questions? Or?
Reluctance to allow
happening and the European or new arrivals were definitely not. What prevented them from actually perceiving that, you know, once there's a problem, we have a problem here and we can learn from this? Why was this so overbearing? Was the territorial, it was like the idea of the non-existence of stewardship, the idea of ownership versus stewardship? Was that?
That's a good way of putting it. The problem was that they were not considered human. They were considered a natural early form of human beings. And the important thing would be to bring them into the religious orbit. And so they literally came here to basically convert people, to bring them into their. They didn't. The French certainly did come to convert. The Puritans came to inhabit, and they just killed the people who got in their way. They just wanted the land. They didn't care.
Why was this blinder there? Like, you're succeeding, and you're not. And I'll tell you, like, for one, we bought a farm, knowing nothing about farming, okay, because we didn't want to do beach. And somehow we thought we needed 320 acres, which separated us from what we didn't want to see. Within 3 seasons on that farm, we saw what was happening on the land. And we understood, you know, what was working and what wasn't. You know, what the cultivated fields, they had lots of grasshoppers, and the natural fields didn't. You know, I mean, it was so obvious. It was, like, how could you not see this? Am I looking at this from a 21st century lens?
I think so. I think. When Jacques Cartier first arrived, he was going past Prince Edward Island and he saw a river coming in from the land. So they sent a boat in to see what it was about. And they started going up the river, and then they saw up in the distance a bunch of canoes pass as if on a separate street. But the wind was blowing towards them, so they hailed as much as they could, but no one could hear them. So they returned to the boat, and I thought it was such a fascinating capsule of that meeting. They didn't see each other, and what Cartier described was the plentiful food that was growing wild. It was all fields, but he didn't recognize them as fields because they looked natural. They just didn't see it. Why? Absolutely. That was the objective, was to find a road to China. But you know, the thing is, they needed to build a colony. And in the French situation, because of the wars of religion, they had no one who was willing to come from France to that colony. So they decided to take the indigenous people and turn them into colonists. So that's why they wanted to convert them. In the more Protestant areas, it was just that they were in the way and they wanted the land. Some of them, in the early days, were looking for a passage to China. Later, they were just looking for the rich land. I just learned this last week that Iowa has something like half the topsoil in the United States. There was areas of incredibly rich land, and when the Puritans arrived, the humans that were here were just in the way. They wanted to build the vision of a city on the hill based on their fantasy of what Jerusalem was once. They wanted to build that. So, and they sort of founded white nationalism. They could not tolerate the indigenous people in their culture. So there's lots of different experiences in different places. No, Jacques Cartier in passing. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Should we?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, you're saying the settlers that arrived here, they had the idea of empire building, kind of what you call today. You know, well, I mean, and you think that this derives from herding culture? But even if you look at, I mean, the empire, as you know, the haven't fully understood how that divides from herding culture.
Okay, well, the herding culture developed the concept of social hierarchies. The social hierarchies evolved into empire, basically. It evolved into societies where there would be a king, there would be a chief. And that's basically what happened. If you had these different herding groups fighting each other, and one of them started beating the others back, he wouldn't throw the herders out. He needed them to herd the animals. He would just make sure that they respected his priority. And so he would become like a king of them. He would become the leader. And he would find himself faced with another one that was doing the same thing somewhere else, and they would fight out for territory. It comes from, it's basically an inevitable process if you look at the arguments of Anki Becker, that the hierarchies have to grow out of that. But the fact of that transfer of illnesses was the thing that made them dominate. It wasn't their strength, it was that. Yes? Well, thank you very much. Yes? Yes. Yeah, well, there you go. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and let's look at all of that. This has been, it's as usual, a pleasure to be with you today. And I want to thank the wonderful organization that you guys have. I've been involved in this kind of thing. It's a lot of work, a lot of dedication, and I really admire you for keeping it up. Thanks very much.